Я не буду сидеть и
This is my 17th contribution to a budget debate in this House, my 4th as a member of the government. It is also the last budget before general election takes place later this year. I've been collecting data for these debates therefore for the past 17 years. It's important to make a point once again that there is a vast improvement in the volume of information that is available and in the accessibility to that information compared to what was the case when I first started. This improvement benefits both sides of the House, but is particularly beneficial to the opposition. Indeed, as I have remarked before, 16 years ago, Hansard was not available until nearly a year after the event. This severely curtailed the ability of the then opposition to do its work. How things have changed, Mr. Speaker. The existence of something as simple as a Parliament website means that a considerable amount of information is now placed in the public domain automatically. These changes reflect the government's commitment to the democratic agenda. That democratic agenda listed 28 points. 20 of these have been finalized, and the remainder unfrozen. Hansard is now produced far quicker than before, and it is placed online. The proceedings of the House are now televised. We have delivered a more inclusive form of politics. Collective decision making for the Cabinet is now the norm. A command paper and a bill on freedom of information legislation have been published. The Chief Minister has answered questions from the electorate once a quarter. A 20-year rule for the release of documents is in place. A public interest disclosure act has been adopted. A ministerial and parliamentary code are nearly finalized. There have been more meetings in Parliament than ever before, with no limit on the number of opposition questions. More economic and financial data is published by the government automatically online than ever before. These are not cosmetic changes, Mr. Speaker. The way in which the vote works has been transformed. The opposition should not belittle what has been achieved. We have gone as far as the pledges in our manifesto allow. This is, after all, what we were elected to do. However, in some cases, we have gone even further than the manifesto itself. The reforms that have been introduced go to the very heart of the way in which Parliament places information, including its proceedings, before the press and before the people. It is a fact that the system in place now is therefore far superior to what was there before. The DSD, Mr. Speaker, has spent some time to reform the system over a period of 14 years, and they did not. The plain fact is that in a quarter of the time, we have already gone much further than they ever did. Mr. Speaker, the House knows, moving on now, the House knows that this is the 75th anniversary of the wartime evacuation of the majority of the civilian population of the Volta. The government has put out one of that generation of the Victorians. A series of activities to commemorate this landmark in the political development of the Volta and its people have already taken place, and more will follow. A set of stamps were issued last year. A dedicated website on the evacuation has been set up by the National Archives in the Volta. The archives have used the website as a focal point for the creation of a register of former evacuees. The number of persons who have registered online and in person has exceeded all expectations. The result of the success of the project was that a memorial event had to be moved from the evacuation roundabout to Kersley Square, quite simply because there was not enough room at the former location to accommodate everyone. There are now over 700 people in the register of evacuees, and they will be invited to the events that have been planned for later on in the year. The House will know that a very successful exhibition on the subject took place at the John Mackintosh Hall last month. This included photographs and memorabilia showing evacuee life in Madeira, Jamaica, Northern Ireland, and London. The exhibition generated considerable interest. There were always groups of people browsing over the photographs and over the other exhibits. I had the pleasure myself of seeing a young group of people, groups of young school children being taken around the different exhibition rooms. The government would like to thank Mr. Joe Jingle, who very kindly donated the majority of the material to the archives for this purpose. Mr. Speaker, given the success of the exhibition, I'm happy to report that the exhibits have been converted into digital formats, and the government intends to place everything online. Therefore, the whole collection is available electronically, all day, every day, to anyone in the world or indeed in the whole world. The highlight of the evacuation commemoration so far was a memorial event which took place on Friday the 22nd of May. This was the anniversary of the exact day when the first evacuees sailed to French Morocco on the government scheme 75 years ago. It is a pleasure for the government to have marked the occasion in a way which clearly touched those people who were forced to leave our shores under threat of war so many years ago. The memorial event and the reception which followed were both very well attended, as was the earlier talk by Dr. Suzanne Saunders Brown from the University of the West Indies. The Chief Minister has already announced that Monday, the 7th of September, this year will be a public holiday, known as Evacuation Commemoration Day. This is a fitting tribute to the sacrifice made by many thousands. The day will serve to remember further those evacuees who are no longer with us, and at the same time to again honor those who remain. The details of forthcoming events will be announced nearer the time. Mr. Speaker, it is important to commemorate the evacuation of this juncture for a number of reasons. Firstly, because the sad reality is the number of evacuees will have regrettably diminished by the time the 100th anniversary comes round. Secondly, because younger generations of Gibraltarians should learn about this watershed and the political development of Gibraltar. The government considers that it is essential that young people come to understand and to appreciate the sacrifices made by their forefathers, without which Gibraltar, as we know it, would not exist today. Indeed, it is the understanding and appreciation of our history and of the struggles of the past that prepares us best for the challenges of the future. Mr. Speaker, I would like to take this opportunity to thank everyone who was involved with the exemplary organization to date of the evacuation event. This includes the archivist and his staff, the Ministry for Culture, the political section, the press team, and finally my own personal staff in Antwerp. In the same vein, Mr. Speaker, last year a very successful seminar on self-determination was held at the Dyson Library. A number of high-profile international and local academics looked at the concept in different angles. There was considerable debate and discussion. The right of self-determination of the people of Gibraltar featured specifically in the presentations that were delivered and in the questions afterwards. There was also discussion on the subject of devolution and regional identity, with an examination of the case study of Scotland, the Basque Country, and Catalonia. The imposition of direct rule on the Turks and Caicos and self-determination in relation to the Falkland Islands were also raised. I know that my friend and colleague Jerry Fine contributed to the debate. Mr. Speaker, this year a follow-up seminar will take place on the 22nd to the 24th of October at the Galveston Library. The subject matter will cover the Second World War and the status and progress towards decolonization through the principle of self-determination. In this way, the World War II theme will tie in very well to the parallel commemoration of the wartime evacuation of the Victoria. I would like to thank the director and staff of the Galveston Library for the continued assistance with this project. Mr. Speaker, I move on now to Europe. In December, I was formally allocated the portfolio of European Affairs and Political Lobbying. This formalized the work which my office had already been doing for some time. Indeed, it was already taking up an ever-increasing amount at that time. It should be recalled that in August 2013, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, formally requested the involvement of the European Commission after the unacceptable and deliberate delay generated by Spain at the border. The government continues to actively bring the situation at the border to the attention of the European Commission. Reports are compiled in my office every month and sent to the Commissioner responsible in Brussels. The Chief Minister and I held several meetings with Commissioner Malmström, who handles the Home Affairs with me in the Barroso Commission. And more recently, I have met with Commissioner Adamopoulos in the Juncker Commission, who is responsible for migration and border management. There have been two inspection visits to the country. The first took place in September 2013 and the second in July 2014. The House knows that the Commission made a number of recommendations following them from those visits. The Commission saw in July 14 that the Volta had complied with the recommendations that had been made to us. They also saw, as a state of the government and to any impartial observer, that Spain had not complied by the due date. This is reflected in the tone of the Commission's subsequent letter to Spain of the 30th of July 2014. The Commission took up a number of issues with Spain. This included the entry checks that Spain was then conducting on persons and visas leaving that country. The Commission called for the intensity of these to be reduced or eliminated completely. The waiting time was then up to 5 hours to enter Spain. The Commission described in that letter as disproportionate. The Commission also postponed it, but a period of time during which 100% of vehicles were upset were not compatible with a sound risk-based approach that such cost checks would be eliminated. Spain was also asked to increase the planned number of lanes going into the country from 2, 1 red and 1 green, to 3, 1 red and 2 green. The Commission expressed concern that Spain had not discussed the programme 10 free works with the voter, and although not so valid and sent to the United Kingdom late in the day, they urged there to be direct engagement between the voter and Spain as well. There has to this day been no formal direct engagement with the voter, and our information is that the not so valid was never received. Mr. Speaker, it is probably not a state this house that the work on the French side of the border appear to have been designed to cause the maximum disruption possible at different points in time. There is no doubt that with better planning, organization, and coordination, it would have been possible to carry out these works with a minimum of inconvenience to those crossing the border in another direction. Sadly, this is not happening. On the 2nd of February 2015, the European Commission met Spain in order to discuss the implementation of the technical recommendations. This meeting confirmed that the works relevant to France's flow will be ready by the end of June 2015, and that the works of the men will take until the end of the year. The House knows that this information was released by the European Commission in response to probing from the Petitions Committee of the European Parliament. It is significant to note that the Commission, concerning the data supplied by Spain itself, has concluded that although the number of checks and persons have decreased, it is still high. The government takes note that the Commission has acknowledged that the vote has progressed in adopting the relevant measures to address the recommendations that they made. In the case of Spain, however, they make it clear that further efforts are needed in order to balance the intensity and frequency of threats with the objectives being pursued. The Speaker has a just recognition of the efforts made by Gibraltar that the European Commission has now acknowledged, just as previously we take these matters. Whether these structural changes in the French side will be completed in the time scale given remains to be seen. These changes must be accompanied by different procedures in order for there to be any real and sustained improvement in the flow rates of traffic across the border. Mr. Speaker, we will wait and see. It is certainly very useful for the government to be able to engage directly with the European Commission and with other institutions in Brussels. The House will recall that France will have a work with the EUID and the Ministry for the Environment, the Spanish complaints against the artificial reef, the bunkering of vessels, and the land reclamation in the East Bank that will dismiss. That is to say, the Commission found that on examining these cases, have been no breach of the EU on the part of Gibraltar. It is also significant that complaints about pollution in Western Beach caused by leading fluid connections with storm drain in Spain have finally been addressed. This complaint was first made many years ago by the Environmental Safety Group and the Grand Watson. It moved the Spanish state for many years until we raised the issue directly during the meeting in Brussels with relevant commissioners. Finally, Spain has accepted liability for the problem, and we now wait a programme of work to see when they intend to rectify. Mr. Speaker, it is important to stress that results will not always go away, nor will they be to our liking, but at least this is a positive start. In the area of taxation, for example, the government continues to be concerned at the way which Spain is manipulating the European institutions with a totally political agenda. This is one of the reasons why my friend and colleague, the Chief Minister, addressed the Tax Committee of the European Parliament during our visit there in May. The fact that he wrote a case to appear before the committee after one request was not left in the chamber. In this context, it is important to know that Gibraltar was not included in the list of 30 tax havens published by the European Commission last week. However, Mr. Speaker, we have seen Spanish commissioners, Spanish members of the European Parliament, and even Spanish judges adopt questionable positions on Gibraltar and France. Spain continues to push on these facts. Therefore, the government continues to raise the voter profile in Brussels in different ways. This year, I have visited the EU institutions 3 times. on one of his occasions with the chief minister. In each visit, he had chosen to concentrate on specific issues, like the border, taxation, or immigration. In January, a very successful exhibition was held at the European Parliament. The location of the stand on the main third floor concourse worked very well, and many MEPs official and British approached us to learn more about the visitor. Indeed, it also led to the ire of the senior party of the Black MEP, who brought television cameras to the stand and denounced it as a provocation to Spain. The result, Mr. Speaker, was an increase in the number of visitors as a consequence of the additional publicity. I also took the opportunity to meet two commissioners, the latter both being responsible for transport, including aviation, and the Regional Development Commissioner, Corina Freshi. At the end of May, the World House in Boston was officially opened by the chief minister. The building will serve as a nerve center for the government's enhanced operations in Boston. Indeed, it had been needed a days before it was officially opened by both the Financial Services Commission and the Citizens Advance Bureau. The government was delighted with the interest shown in the British Bank in Europe by ambassadors, members of the European Parliament, Brussels-based think tanks, and the media. The government's activities in Boston are guided and directed by Sir John Watson, whose energy, commitment, and network of connections have already proved to be extremely useful. A lawyer from EUID, Daniel Bernardi, has been seconded there. There are two interns recruited locally in the same way as Macron in the EU, and one original member of staff who has served the board for more than 10 years, including speaking. The speaker of the government is confident that this team, supported from a legal perspective by the Attorney General Michael Yana and politically by myself, will assist in putting this water message across in Brussels. I must also, at this stage, express the gratitude of the government to the United Kingdom representation, UKRIP, who have been very helpful during the period of the establishment of the office and with whom we continue to work closely. Mr. Speaker, on aviation, the government welcomes the decision taken by the United Kingdom in relation to the inclusion of the water airport in EU civil aviation measures. The government has been assured that this remains a red line issue for the UK. In a written statement to Parliament earlier this month, the Parliamentary Undersecretary to the UK Department of Transport, Robert Woodville, said that the UK will continue to press for the extension of air passenger rights legislation to the water airport, in line with the EU treaty. The House can rest assured that this government will continue to lobby at every opportunity, particularly in Brussels, to ensure that our position is understood. We cannot do more than has been done at present. In January, as part of this strategy, I addressed the European Policy Centre, which is one of the main think tanks in Brussels, precisely on the subject of aviation, coupled with an explanation of our position as part of the European Union. The hall was packed with diplomats, officials, MEPs, and journalists. This helped to get across the diverse point of view. In March of this year, I was able to meet with a number of vice presidents of the Transport Committee of the European Parliament and with different spokespersons from different political groups. It was important that the water message continue to be heard face to face. For the first time, I also met with the coordinator of the European People's Party, which contains friends by Peter Babylon. The article recalled that the EPP voted against the water's inclusion in civil aviation legislation as a bloc. It was a lively meeting, but nonetheless a very useful one. Mr. Speaker, the position of the government that the voters entitled to inclusion in EU civil aviation legislation as a right. The UK acted accepting this area of community policy which do not apply to the voter. Aviation is not listed among them. Therefore, the exclusion of the extension of the voter for such measures would run against the treaty and would be illegal. The government continues to argue that there was already a wording agreed upon between the voter, the UK and Spain for the application here of EU law on civil aviation. This was a clause which stated that such legislation would apply without prejudice to the decisions of the UK and Spain and to the sovereignty of the land on which the airport is situated. The acceptance by Spain of this language between 2006 and 2011 meant that EU civil aviation law was extended to the water during that time. However, it's important to point out that this principle was applied going forward and in relation to new and amending legislation, but it was not applied going backwards. In other words, Guatemala required the UK and Spain to seek the inclusion of the water in 2006 measures as well. This did not materialize and has further complicated the situation. Mr. Speaker, The House knows that at the end of 2011, the new Spanish government failed to defend us with the 3% kind of need. And we are where we are today as a result of that. In other words, progress on the EU as we get here is not being held back by Gibraltar and is not being held back by the UK. It is important that the blame for the center is placed right roundly and squarely upon Spain. Mr. Speaker, the House will know that Gibraltar will be included in the referendum to determine whether the UK should leave the EU or remain within. The UK and the Gibraltar government are now engaged in discussing the detail of the legislation that will be required to make this happen as well as the timing. The Chief Minister has asked the Attorney General Michael Yama tonight to represent Gibraltar in the working group that has been created between the two governments. Good progress has been made. Mr. Speaker, the government welcomes the political decision to include Gibraltar in the UK referendum because we are part of the EU and clearly have something to say on the subject. It is no secret that the view of the government is that both Gibraltar and the UK should remain in the EU. This is the case for both political and economic reasons. We all know that our experience with the European Union over the years has been far from perfect. For many years, many of us have wanted the EU to be more robust when it comes to clearing things for accounts over behavior towards the border. Very often we play by the rules of the club and we do not enjoy the benefits of the club. I have told them this in practice myself to the faces. However, the harsh reality is that without the framework of rules provided by the EU, Spain would and could do not work. Who can forget the report that early on the Partido Popular had commissioned a study to see where they could close the country? Who can forget Mr. Margaret's plan for a front at home, which was scuppered by the European Commission? Things are not perfect in the EU, Mr. Speaker, but we can work together to make things better. Before I close on the subject of Europe, I would like to welcome the recent visit to the Gibraltar by Cecilia Wikström MEP, who is the chair of the Petitions Committee of the European Parliament. The government is convinced that there is no better advertisement for the voter, no better advocate for the voter than the voter itself. We have nothing to hide. It was a very useful visit. This week, a group of parliamentary assistance committees arrived in the voter on a fact-finding visit. They come from Estonia, Hungary, the United Kingdom, and Poland. It's important to make sure that the assistants are well briefed of the reality of the voter, because very often MEPs depend on them for advice. The government intends to continue giving to the voter by relevant MEPs and also by parliamentary assistance. I will take the opportunity to thank Michael Yama and the EID for their assistance and support to this new ministry. I would also like to thank Sir John Watson and the staff at the Voter House in Dublin. Mr. Speaker, I move on now to my responsibility for civil aviation. Within the UK, responsibility for the conduct of aviation security inspections in all UK airports, including those of the Crown Dependency and the Gibraltar, as part of the Department for Transport and the Civil Aviation Authority. In common with other European airports and in response to European legislation that will come into effect on the 1st of September, the airport is preparing for the increased use of explosive-based detection equipment in the screening process. Although already used in the screening of hand luggage, the legislation will, for the first time, allow the use of explosive-based detection equipment in certain circumstances in the screening of passengers in lieu of standard handsets. The use of this equipment will be less intrusive for passengers and will help to speed up the screening process. To meet the required requirements, the effort will be the process of procuring one additional explosive-based detection equipment. Mr. Speaker, during the course of the last financial year, as a part of the ongoing work in preparation for the Tamil project, the government has significantly upgraded the security fencing along almost the entire length of the FBC northern boundary. The remaining area of the northern boundary without fencing is the part of the very eastern of the airport which cannot be completed until after the final works have been finished. Mr. Speaker, on aviation safety, the Gibraltar Airport emergency orders have been completely revisited during the last year. The air terminal was fully exercised as part of these new orders, which incorporated new roles that have not been previously practiced before. There was a very positive feedback from the staff that participated. Indeed, three full-scale exercises were taking place at the airport, which also integrated response into both the airport and the Gibraltar Emergency Services. The second exercise was observed by a specialist inspector from the UK Civil Aviation Authority and received very favourable comments. The continuing efforts made by all departments, including in the plan to take ownership of their respective areas and to get improvements, deserve recognition, and I would like to record my thanks for all their efforts. received an acknowledgement to the Minister with responsibility for tourism, Samantha Sacramento will deal with airport issues in more detail. I simply want to congratulate her and the Swedish Australian sector for the growth of 8.1% in the number of passengers handled to the airport. There's also been a growth of 4.7% in entertainment. The training services provided by Ryanair to Tangier and EasyJet to Bristol have no doubt contributed to this growth. I continue to make a close emphasis on this matter, having studied tourism and nutrition for more than 10 years. Mr. Speaker, I welcome the fact that work has continued to improve the passenger experience at the assembly, with all staff now receiving disability awareness training specific to the aviation industry. And again, I congratulate my colleagues on this. I take this opportunity to thank the Director of Civil Aviation, the External Director, and the management and staff of the Borders and Coast Guard Agency. Mr. Speaker, I move on now to my responsibility for town planning. The government is satisfied with the commitments it made in relation to town planning are either in place or in progress. The town planner is the chairman of the DTC. The meetings of the committee matter place in public. Objectives and applicants are held at DTC meetings as a matter of right. A subcommittee of the DTC has been set up in leadership excellence minor role. The ESG is now a valued voting member of the DTC. The minutes, decisions, and agenda of the DTC meetings are published online. A new town planning act is about to be published with a command paper. A part of the planning process is now available online. The rest is to follow. The government projects are subject to the planning process using a mechanism which has worked very well. The details of all government applications are available online. There can be little doubt, Mr. Speaker, that by any objective analysis, the planning process is now light years ahead of the standards. No system is perfect, but we have today certainly a huge improvement compared to the system that we inherited. The level of public participation and the level of public debate and interest in the planning process has exceeded all expectations. This is a good thing. It doesn't stand in the room only for the public and the media in the DTC. The position continues to be obsessed with telling the top back to the system that they need to decide over. We have replaced that frequency with transparency. We have chosen a closed system. We have replaced a closed system with an open one. We have let the public into the planning process when they set them up. We speak of over 1,645 planning applications from January 2012 until the end of May 2015. 250 of those related to government projects. The policy of the government continues to be that under the new legislation, the views of the DTC must be taken into account by all applicants, including by the government itself. Mr. Speaker, it is important to highlight the fact that there is already more information available online automatically about planning applications than ever before. As I have indicated, the ultimate objective of the government remains to make the whole planning process of any application available online. I'm pleased to tell the House that the development of this policy is now in its final stage. Mr. Speaker, in planning, we make the planning process even more accessible and interactive with the public. This is in line with the overall policy of the government to increase contact with the public electronically. It is important to stress once again that at the same time as the improvement in electronic interaction between the department and the public, there has also been a reinforcement of staff on the ground. The system that we inherited is unsustainable, Mr. Speaker. There was no proper structure which allowed for succession planning and for smooth internal operation. There are now two young assistant town planners who were locally recruited in place. Their town planning assistants with proper job descriptions that they naturally came into office. This has resulted in improvements for the staff and improvements for the public. There are also more administrative experience in place. Mr. Speaker, at a meeting of the Urban Renewal Committee earlier this year, it was decided to commence the review of the Resilient Development Plan. This will be a work in progress and it will take time. The last plan dates back to 2009. The traditional practice was for these plans to be reviewed every 10 years, which means that the 1991 plan will be reviewed by the energy of the government on or around 2001. It took 8 more years for this to happen until 2009, when the new plan was finally formally put in place. The number of building control applications received continues to increase, with an all-time record of over 500 applications processed in 2014. There has also been a record number of approval notices issued, which now stands at over 400. This is reflected in our all-time record with respect to revenue generated by the Department of £289,000 2025. The government has recently advertised for the post of TG1 in the Building Control Department, where the intention is to also provide, over a period of time, a similar succession training as in Hong Kong. I would like to take this opportunity to thank the management and staff of the Hong Kong and the Building Control Department for the continued positive and professional approach. The public servants have been well instrumental in the successful delivery of the policies of the government. The Speaker of Hong Kong and Building Control Department is ahead of schedule, and the total amount of estimated expenditure for this financial year, 15-16, is £1.17 million. Mr. Speaker, the first one is briefly now on urban renewal and land. A new urban renewal officer is now in place at the town planning department. There are a number of useful projects that the department has now embarked upon as a result. This includes the compilation of a database which will show all vacant properties in the water, particularly in the upper town area. This work will culminate in the long term with the creation of an action plan for areas of the upper town that most need work, and where action is most critical. It is important to make the point that in many cases buildings are not owned by the government. This means there will be a need to work closely with the private sector landlords when the time comes. It is also relevant to point out that Land Property Services Limited and the Ministry for Housing are now engaged in identifying those government owned properties that can be put out to tender in the upper town. This has already happened both with individual dwellings and with building clusters. It is clear to the government that there is a demand for these properties, and the policy will remain to regenerate the upper town and bring it back to life in this way. Mr. Speaker, during the financial year 14-15, 19 residential properties were advertised and sold by tender. In addition to this, 7 commercial properties have been advertised to tender during the same financial year. A number of sites have been advertised for expressing interest. This includes the older terminal, the Mount, Lateral Barracks, Parade Ground, the KBD site, part of the Victory Yard, and Central Police Station. A number of these are still open for applications or pending assignments, further discussion or completion. I would like to take the opportunity to thank the management and staff of Land Property Services Limited and at the Land Office in Compton Place for their assistance and support throughout the year. Mr. Speaker, the House will recall our commitment and opposition to ensure that prime stock plots of land were not permitted to continue to lie idle. We want to ensure that developers developed. This is a policy we have pursued in government. It has turned out to be very successful. We have been critical of the terms that the previous government had negotiated with the Ocean Village Group when we were in opposition, and we vowed to change this. These changes were made. The result is that the Wakefield Centre project has finally got off the ground. This is an example of a project that has been stalled for a number of years that is now finally moving. There will be others in the future. The government has come to an agreement with developers in the midterm site, whereby part of the plot is handed back to us. The remainder of that plot, as the people who said earlier, is now finally being developed. The announcement made last week in relation to the east side also falls into this category. The government negotiated and agreed to buy back the plot of land from its original owners for £28 million, after the plot has been allowed to lie idle for many years. It will be sold for £82 million, by way of cash premium, and will lead to the development of the Blue Water Reserve. There are plenty of public gains in this project. This includes over 1,000 affordable homes, a car park, a public pool on the east side, and a law enforcement marine base. We speak of the social development value of the project will be an investment in the water in the region of £1.1 billion. This will deliver considerable economic growth and opportunity for employment. The government is forward to adjust to the project of Reed and other developments. It is important to point out that the estimate from the Building Control Department of the private sector capital investment in the water has grown to £106.8 million in 2013. Mr. Speaker, by way of conclusion, I would also like to say a few words on the delivery of the GSLP Liberal Manifesto, which has been a program of government over the last 3.5 years. Time has gone by quickly. We have taken our commitment to the electorate extremely seriously. In the recent past, other governments have regarded the manifesto as little more than a whisper. We took the view in opposition that this is not good enough. A manifesto is much more than a vague idea or a rough indication of the way in which the government intends to proceed. A manifesto is a commitment to the electorate. your commitment to this government takes seriously. It is true that sometimes the best government plans can be thrown, of course, by unforeseen circumstances. This has happened to all governments and it will happen to us too. There are areas where we have to accommodate the commitment at a different location and devote it, either technically or other considerations. The death of the park up in the center of town will remove the full distance from beneath Conway Park to above the Formation Road. The bathing area at Mid Harbour has now been divided in the Gaster area, and so on. However, the number and proportion of manifesto commitments, which are complete, in progress or ongoing, is without precedent in the water, and the government takes considerable pride in this achievement. From Commonwealth Park to affordable housing, to small boat marina, to the university and the new schools, to improvements in health and elderly care, this is tangible and therefore all to see. Mr. Speaker, there are those who will nonetheless still choose to lift it no matter what the government does. In many ways, the arguments of the speaker's parade are often inconsistent or contradictory. For example, those who held 40 meetings of Parliament a year now call for greater democracy. Those who practice a closed system of town planning call for greater transparency. Those who need to carry out capital works using government companies complain when others continue the same practice. Those who decided over 16 years of traffic closure mock the positive solutions that we have started to roll out. Their approach is one of do as I say and not as I do. Mr. Speaker, this is not a credible way for an opposition to conduct the business. Having said that, it is also clearly a matter for them. However, the electorate will see through it. They will see through the second pillar of the strategy also, which is the well-worn tactic of scaremongering. This is finally the approach they have chosen to adopt on matters like the LNG power station, on public finances, or on the savings bank. The reality is that by any objective analysis, this government has improved Gibraltar for the better. We have progressed forward with the physical fabric of Gibraltar with improvements that link to the practice as an important addition to our legislative framework as well. I think that the government knows that everything is not perfect and there is still plenty of work to be done. No government can be perfect. However, it is clear nonetheless as we approach an election that we are taking Gibraltar's new strides forward in a positive direction. This video concludes by thanking you, the clerk, and the staff of the House for your support throughout the year. I also want to publicly thank my personal staff in my office at number 6 from the place. Thank you.
It is an honor to stand here today to deliver my first budget address. The last before a general election when the people of Gibraltar will be able to take account and analyze exactly how, in their minds, we have failed as a government. It is my honest opinion, Mr. Speaker, that we have done well. It is impossible to please everyone, but I sincerely think that we have managed by our thorough manifesto promises to steer Gibraltar well into the future. Our successes across the board have been noteworthy indeed. 2 new schools, a university for Gibraltar, almost 1,000 new affordable homes already close to completion, and a new 1,700 recently announced. The refurbishment of the once forgotten housing estate, public meetings at the GCC, a new small boat movement, a draft traffic plan, a new psychiatric unit, Commonwealth Park, achieving the lowest levels of unemployment ever seen locally, a new bank for Gibraltar, the Gibraltar Mega Music Festival, a new ID card. The list goes on and on, Mr. Speaker. I am very proud of being part of this team, working together for what we believe is for the good of Gibraltar. Clearly, not all will agree with us, not least the honourable member sitting across the floor. Mr. Speaker, clearly they would have done things differently. Of course they would have. But they had the chance for almost 6 years in government. Now it's our turn. Mr. Speaker, I sincerely think that most will agree, and I am very confident that this will become evident when the time comes for the electorate to choose the way forward. That we have done very well indeed. Mr. Speaker, I would now turn my attention to my ministerial responsibilities and start with technical services, a department that often goes by without sufficient mention. as quietly, are responsible for providing all sorts of advice and know-how to the vast majority of government projects. I wish to put on record that I am most grateful for the assistance provided by such a professional and hard-working department. I can still recall my first briefing meeting when the one thing that ran out most clearly was that the department felt that they were not being put to their full use. Too much outsourcing is being done then, and the department felt that they could do so much more. Today, TSC is the heart of most government projects. During the past financial year, the department has been involved in a number of projects covering a large variety of areas, such as social protection work and rockfall prevention, as well as works in relation to their defined responsibilities, such as highway maintenance and works to the main sewer, amongst others. On the coastal work side, Civil Service has been directly responsible for the delivery of two major projects, the Sandy Bay Beach project and the detection and regeneration project was completed in time for last year's bathing season, and has seen a major transformation with the creation of a wide stable beach. Something that has not been the case for a number of years now. The project is one of our manifesto commitments. The department has also led on the North Mole Reformation project, which is currently underway. This project will see the existing western arm extended northwest by just under 120 meters. In all, 9 concrete casings have been sunk to create the perimeter of a new reformation. Approximately 80,000 tons of rubble from the east side will be processed as fill material, and a new landmass of approximately 10,000 meters squared will be created. These works are earmarked for completion in July this year. For the incoming year, Civil Service will continue to develop various other coastal works projects, including regular maintenance of the existing coastal defences. Turning now to case stabilisation and rockfall prevention projects. Following a tender award, the department carried out road stabilisation works above Windmill Hill Road in an area which has suffered from a major landslide. In addition, assessments and designs for further rockfall protection measures at East Side Slope and Green Lane were commenced and are currently ongoing as part of the government's grid stabilisation and rockfall prevention programme, which will continue during this financial year. Technical service departments have also been fully involved with the need to relocate the motorcycle club from Brian Navajo Way to a new site within the government's Process Industrial Park. The original motorcycle club suffered extensive structural damage following a major rockfall in November 2012. Given the rockfall hazard that exists in this area, a new site for the motorcycle club was identified within the Governor's Cottage Camp Industrial Park. The department acted as project manager at all stages of design, including the procurement and construction of the club. I am pleased to announce that this was completed in November 2014. Mr. Speaker, with regards to highways maintenance, the works program has once again been successful over the past year with ongoing repairs to roads, footpaths and retaining roads. Resurfacing work has been carried out during the past year to a strip of the Roper Road, the south of the 1772 Club, where a new footpath has also been constructed to improve pedestrian safety in the area. Additionally, resurfacing work has also seen the extension of the Catherine Bay car park to provide better parking facilities for beach users and the resurfacing of a new temporary coach park on the site of the old air terminal. The replacement of telephone crossing lights and equipment has been undertaken in a number of locations, working jointly with the Gibraltar Electricity Authority. This year saw the introduction of countdown timers at the Lion World Road crossing. This was as a direct result of the recommendations of the Sustainable Transport, Traffic and Parking Plan, the STPP for short. Yes, Mr. Speaker, the plan, which received much attention of late, often mocked up by the Honourable Member of the Office, a plan that they themselves would have been proud of, a plan that they would not describe to their own admission, and that is clearly a very good thing. A plan that the members of the would wish to invest, for who can imagine what reason. Well, it is this government's general policy as part of this plan that we encourage people to adopt alternative and more sustainable modes of transport, the most basic of which is walking itself. In order to do this, it is the government's view that we must provide the necessary infrastructure and facilities to make walking safer, more comfortable, and hence accessible to the population at large. These countdown timers will help to do exactly that. They inform the pedestrian of the time that they have left to cross, and therefore give them confidence to look back when crossing the road. Christians can therefore now take an informed decision as to whether they will have enough time to pray, and there is no confusion between Christ and progressions as to who has right and way. The program to improve our existing progression courses will continue during the coming year, with installation of further countdown timers at some of our busiest progression routes. Importantly, there will also be important new progression improvements at the Trafalgar interchange by way of a new passing crossing at Better Start, something very much needed and was very obvious that came across loud and clear as part of the public consultation process of the STCPP. This new process of Better Start is earmarked for completion shortly. As in previous years, the department continues to successfully manage road closures and diversions on the public highway, both with own in-house work and for all utility companies and contractors, in a manner that balances the need to undertake works again, allowing vehicles to circulate. The increased construction activity generated by new projects makes this task increasingly difficult. In order to reduce the impact of road closures, works are only carried out avoiding peak times wherever possible. And after hours and weekend work, as always, is a default condition imposed on contractors in order to minimize inconvenience to the public. As stated in my last budget speech, Mr. Speaker, a comprehensive major reception program was commenced by the department last year in an effort to tackle the underinvestment in road maintenance in past years. Major reception works were undertaken along Road Road and also along Langwell Road. Over the coming year, the major road reception program will continue with the reception of a southern section of Queensway from Rabbit Park Roundabout and to the Mid Harbour Roundabout. Additionally, the roundabout at Liverpool Avenue, adjacent to the fuel station, which is correctly known as Morrison's Roundabout, has been completely resurfaced. These works were undertaken at off-peak times and weekends, thus avoiding the traffic disruption that would inevitably ensue should these works be carried out during normal working hours. Mr. Speaker, as many will have by now noticed, working along certain stretches of Main Street has become safer for ladies wearing high heel shoes. We are pleased to announce that works to repair the dents in the paving on Main Street have now commenced. These works entail the lifting and relaying of the stone blocks along Main Street and the filling and stabilization of all joints using a special polymer resin. Presently, a special Main Street from its junction with Angels Lane to its junction with Cooper Lane has been completed. This work will be extended to other areas during the course of the year. These works were another one of the manifesto commitments for which the appropriation of funds was sought last year, and this is a vast improvement. The work was an area of concern to many. Mr. Speaker, work to install a new firefighting main and emergency telephone line along the full length of Dudleywood Way Tunnel in line with our manifesto commitments have also been recently completed. During the coming year, mobile phone coverage and ventilation requirements will be designed with a view to improving the current situation as much as possible, working with the constraints imposed by this ex-major tunnel. The measurement place in our major tunnel is a far safer place, making it possible for the essential services to attend to any accident within the tunnel's expedition speed. Mr. Speaker, although I have already touched upon and mentioned the sustainable transport, traffic and parking plan earlier, I will now turn to this major government project and indeed manifesto commitment. The STCPP has been a truly interministerial and interdepartmental project which has seen involvement of technical services including highways and our traffic team, the Ministry for the Environment, the bus company and our consultants, Mark McDowell, who are market leaders in traffic and transport plans across the world for many years. Mr. Speaker, although my shadow has complained about the time that this project has taken, we must understand that for a project of this magnitude, one that cuts across the whole community and affects all of us, whether we choose to drive or not, walk or take the bus or not. This plan is not something that could or indeed can be rushed in any way, shape or form. One cannot spend taxpayers' money on ideas dreamt about one lazy Sunday afternoon, having then to backtrack when it fails to a lack of proper research. Mr. Speaker, this plan is a comprehensive document which will form the blueprint for traffic and transport for at least the next 10 years. Already, the plan has turned some very well thought out ideas which are within the very comprehensive draft documents already published. Mr. Speaker, I am very proud to have delivered a major manifesto commitment in the form of this draft sustainable traffic, transport and passing plan for the data. As part of this plan, and with the use of digital modelling, we now have the means to be able to put certain potential scenarios to test. We can now compare before and after scenarios to compare what we expect of same type and traffic flow. This draft document was open to public consultation until the end of March this year, and our consultants are presently compiling a database of all responses received. The database will set out the issues and suggestions raised by members of the public, and how these will be considered and addressed as part of the work to complete the final version of the plan, which will be earmarked for completion before the end of this year. Mr. Speaker, as part of the work carried out so far, a number of pilot schemes have already been introduced, including a new drop of stone outside St. Joseph's Middle and Primary Schools, as well as the introduction of a temporary roundabout at the junction of Grafton Road and Bayside Road. The changes at St. Joseph's School have brought about mixed comments, ranging from the very positive, from parents picking up and dropping their children off with much greater ease, to a negative of residents who are unhappy about the loss of permanent parking in their area. Parking still exists all day except for 3 hours each day, and parking is restored at all times during weekends, public and school holidays. Change, Mr. Speaker, especially when it comes to parking, is something that is difficult to come to terms with, and any traffic plan will be faced with these issues at every single step of the way. We are currently working very hard with the to the South District to try to find solutions to these in conjunction with other historical issues which have surfaced as a result of these new changes. We are clear that for any plan to work, we have to be brave to enforce things that will hopefully bring about the long-lasting positive changes that will benefit Gibraltar as a whole, including the environment. Mr. Speaker, Gibraltar has one of the largest vehicle ownership rates in the world. The easiest thing politically will be to do nothing until one is forced to do something in the future. It takes a forward-thinking government to try to bring about positive changes in this respect. To be able to see the whole benefit of the plan, one needs to wait until all the parts of the title are in place. This will come about once the final document is read and discussed in order to prepare a plan of action based on the recommendations received. Until then, the picture will be incomplete. Mr. Speaker, on traffic matters, the Department has continued to make good progress this year and seen a number of other improvements and initiatives. Speed indicator devices have been installed on several of our main arterial roads. These speed indicator devices are vehicle activated signs which detect and display real time vehicle speed as vehicles approach them in order to advise drivers of the speed they're traveling at. The aim of these devices is to provide information which will allow drivers to change their behavior towards speed and are one of several measures that form part of a wider speed management plan. In this respect, the department is also carrying out a full review of the speed limits on all of the Gibraltar roads and has commenced a program for the installation of speed cameras on some of the roads which statistically have the highest incident rate in Gibraltar, accident rate in Gibraltar, not rate, in an effort to make our roads safer for all our users. The Ministry for Traffic has been working closely with the Royal Gibraltar Police to ensure that the speed cameras are placed in the most strategic of locations throughout Gibraltar, especially in accident hotspots. There have been other wayfinding measures also set up using speed ramps within densely populated areas, for some of Prince Edward Road, Lower Castle Road, St. George's Estate, and the entrance of Campbell. Mr. Speaker, other initiatives have included the installation of a new pedestrian crossing at Kingsley by the area of King Saxon, and the upgrading of a zebra crossing on Lassie Road to a pedestrian crossing. Apart from the new pedestrian crossing at Bradley South, the Department is currently carrying out a review of crossings at the Trafalgar interchange with a view of making changes to improve circulation routes for pedestrians in this busy junction, which has historically been neglected the needs of those travelling on foot. More initiatives will continue until the final plan is printed and beyond. Mr. Speaker, this plan is not short-term, but a plan for the foreseeable future. Mr. Speaker, in relation to assisting the bus company with improving their service to the public, technical services identified a means to allow buses to turn around within the area of Brian Navajo Way. This area is relatively narrow and in the past prevented buses from safely turning around without the need to maneuver and cause an obstruction and danger to other road users. A purpose was laid by was constructed within an area of waste ground bordering the main road to allow the safe turning circles of buses. This has meant that there is no longer the need of having an extra minibus to service this route, and hence saving may be made to the public purpose. These works were completed at the start of the year at the cost of £57,848.82. Mr. Speaker, moving on to the sewer section. During the past year, flood prevention measures along the 506 Marple Road and at Wellington Front were completed, meaning that the historical problems of flooding in both of these areas during periods of concentrated heavy rainfall will now be a thing of the past. Mr. Speaker, the condition and upkeep of the Gibraltar's main sewer and storm water drainage levels continues to be a matter of great concern for the government, arising from a lack of investment and neglect to what is arguably the most important and essential part of our local infrastructure. To this end, work was carried out to restore large sections of our drains at a number of locations. These have included the main sewer along Rose Road, the main street sewer from Berlin to King Street, and the main stormwater culvert from the Connecticut Road to British Catalana Road. Further to safety works will progressively be extended to other areas. Other works carried out have included the relining of the main sewer along Lango Road from the junction of King Street up to Bonhouse Lane, the lane of a collapsed storm drain along Newport, and the lane of new stormwater culvert at Marina Bay. Funding is once again being provided this financial year for the purchase of equipment to allow the sewer infrastructure section to continue to provide an efficient service in respect of its inspection of the sewer network. Mr. Speaker, this is also the case for the guide and workshop where funding for new equipment is also being provided. They will continue to provide a service to maintain the fleet of government vehicles, including the refuse collection vehicles. The situation within the guide and workshop is also under review, given the previous administration's hurried signing of a collective agreement only a few weeks before the election last, which placed it in a government owned company as an interim measure that would allow them to receive a 12% pay increase. The Speaker of Technical Services Department is one of those government departments who are rarely in the limelight, but they work tirelessly behind the scenes to deliver on their defined responsibilities, maintaining public infrastructure, and to support and provide technical advice to other government agencies and departments. As can be seen, we will continue to do so this coming year in all manner of projects in order to deliver on the government's extensive and comprehensive programme. The Speaker of Technical Services Public Transport. Late last year, an amalgamation of the Ministries of Traffic and Public Transport took place following a reshuffle of ministerial responsibilities. The Ministry is now responsible for the Gibraltar Bus Company together with the local taxi service. Within public transport, there are many challenges that one is faced with in an attempt to improve the provision of such an important service to the community. Furthermore, in order to be truly successful in the policies surrounding the FCTPP and efficient public transport service is essential. The government, by way of the ministry, is continually looking for ways to improve the tax service within Gibraltar. Clearly, there are a multitude of issues that can affect the tax service, as indeed the bus service, the greatest of which are the traffic problems associated and surrounding the frontier and also the airfield barrier crossings. These on a Sunday during the summer schedule closed to allow no less than 9 scheduled flights to land and take off. This added to any potential private or military aircraft and runway cleaning operation in order to lead to great delays and an avoidable deterioration in service. With the barrier down at least 20 times on Sunday, clearly we have a problem. No doubt, a victim of our own success in attracting more flights to the goal of something which we can only be totally proud of. But unfortunately, this will affect other operations in such a small place like ours. It is at the airport arrival terminal that we see the effect of this traffic build-up together with the frontier taxi rank itself. Hence, it is inevitable that this has a bearing on taxi and bus service. We see the government, by way of the recruitment of 5 transit inspectors and installation of the taxi GPS tracking system, has managed to improve the taxi service in some areas, but we continue to work hand in hand with the GPA in order to jointly identify strategies to continue to better the taxi service throughout Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, the new man buses have provided Gibraltar with a much needed improvement to its aging fleet. The previous bus speak was in fact not so much faith as in fact simply saying things of being driven in an environment such as ours where we are facing very quickly high temperatures and narrow winding roads. Indeed, they had clearly not provided the taxpayer with the yield that were promised when they were first purchased. The old blue buses were fitted with American supplied gearboxes, which when the civil service provider in the UK stopped supplying spares became almost impossible to acquire. Therefore, a minor fault in the gearbox meant having to adapt a completely new gearbox from another manufacturer. Once this occurred, the bus's performance was quickly diminished, leading to a steep decline. The new buses are fitted with powerful 6-cylinder engines, which would amply provide them with sufficient torque to remove all historical issues associated with the previous buses already mentioned. Users can enjoy traveling in air-conditioned comfort. These new buses are fully compliant with all the legal provisions applicable to all public service vehicles. Hence, Gibraltar can now be proud of having a state-of-the-art, eco-friendly and modern bus service which will ensure an efficient schedule service for passengers for years to come. Furthermore, Mr. Speaker, government is also looking into purchasing several extra minibuses to service the Upper Town area. Several models have been identified and negotiations with the relevant vehicle dealers are underway. These will also provide an accessible service to all of its users. The present buses are also insufficiently capable of negotiating all of the roads in the Upper Town area, and especially at the junction between Gardens Road and Rope Road. The present bus is lack of clearance due to its basic feeding overhang is causing much damage to the underside of the bus, leading to a great ongoing maintenance cost. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to the Driver and Vehicle Licensing Department. This department is working closely with the Driver and Vehicle Standards Agency for the introduction of a type of work card for our drivers. At the administrative level, a memorandum of understanding has already been drafted, and the VLD is awaiting the DVSA's comments. The department is working closely to try and find a workable solution for our few local HCV drivers. Mr. Speaker, the European Commission has adopted rules for linking national electronic registers of road transport undertakings. This linked-up database is called the European Register of Road Transport Undertakings, or ERU. ERU allows a better exchange of information between member states so that the competent authorities can better monitor the compliance of road transport undertakings with the rules in force. Undertakings that do not respect the rules when operating abroad will face the consequences in the member state where they are based. This creates better competition conditions in the road transport market. The setup of the national registers and their interconnections are required under the legislation on the access to the professional of road transport undertakings. It is in line with this government's commitment that we introduce and comply with all EU legislation, Mr. Speaker. I can safely say that all the necessary procedures to link up this database are now in place and are up and running. Mr. Speaker, as part of government's initiative to provide personalised support and to assist applicants and transport undertakings wishing to complete the new driver certificate of professional competence, initial qualifications and periodic training. Training is being provided by the DVLD and will be ongoing. In the past year, 21 drivers have successfully passed the bus certificate of professional competence and 18 drivers have successfully passed the lorry CPC initial qualification. Moreover, the government, in an effort to ensure that all directive requirements are met, will continue to deliver a 35-hour periodic training for existing drivers during 2015-2016. Presently, 151 bus and 71 lorry drivers have successfully attended the CPC periodic training. With this initiative, those transport undertakings or individual applicants who take advantage of the possibility of completing the 35 hours of road training over the 5-year period will be able to spread the training costs over the full 5-year period. Mr. Speaker, the carriage of dangerous goods by road carries the inherent risk of accidents. Taking into account the safety requirements of vehicles in Gibraltar that carry dangerous goods and according to the transport carriage of dangerous goods by road regulations 2010, governments will continue to provide training to the DVLD's technical staff in order to qualify them for the issue of an authorization certificate to these vehicles. This year, a further course will be held by qualified persons from the Driver and Vehicle Standards Agency in UK in order to train the newly recruited vehicle testers. this book will be heading to Dorset. To speak at the introduction of the motorcycle compulsory basic training course for riders continues to be a tremendous success. Feedback from the public at large has been extremely positive. Due to the fact that demand surpasses supply, government is working with the DDOD and looking into possible measures to increase the delivery of these courses. Mr. Speaker, the demand for the issuing of a new focus on driving license continues to be under increase, and the waiting times for the issuing of these driving licenses continue to be at an all-time low within 5-6 working days. This combined with the success of an extradition counter being provided at the embassy offices is ensuring an excellent service to businesses and the public at large. Mr. Speaker, notwithstanding with that, the driver and vehicle licensing department continues to use information and communication technology as a tool to achieve better customer services. The general public is now able to access a number of online services and applications via a new e-government portal, for example, roadworthiness test booking, energy booking, and driving test and theory test booking. Furthermore, the department is also working on a service to purchase personalized number plates online. These services will allow people to access and pay for such facilities at any time and from the comfort of their own home. This comes as a wealth of new market district coverage opportunities for the DDOD that will appropriately cater for market demand and service requirements. Mr. Speaker, seriously, and in keeping with our manifestation, I am satisfied that all the relevant outstanding EU legislation and amendments have now been transposed. Furthermore, in anticipation, the Department is now working closely with the EUID and studying all future directive proposals in order to expedite the swift implementation as and when the need arises. Moreover, the Department, together with the EUID, is looking to update all existing national traffic and transport legislation and determine ways that will make both apps more user-friendly. Mr. Speaker, the Traffic and Transport Commission continues to meet on a monthly basis. The Traffic Commission is constantly working to assist our citizens in all matters related to traffic, while the Transport Commission works hand in hand with all the transport undertakings and the GTA in order to mutually find strategies to continue to better the public service in Gibraltar. To this effect, I am very satisfied that both these bodies have been able to promulgate all traffic and transport related regulations successfully. From here, I would like to thank all the members of both commissions, many of which are appointed volunteers. Mr. Speaker, EREG is the Association of European Vehicle and Driver Registration Authorities. It is a European cooperative made up of all the European registration authorities dealing with subjects concerning registration and documentation of vehicles and drivers. The main objective of EREG is to bring together all the European registration authorities to be able to share knowledge, experience, and good practice, and also identify, follow, and influence European development and regulation. I was proud to announce that from the 3rd to the 5th of June 2015, the EREG General Meeting and Annual Conference took place here in Gibraltar. Government is positive that having held this conference here will further strengthen existing rules and procedures between European authorities and Gibraltar, making this beneficial not only to the driver and vehicle licensing department, but to Gibraltar as a whole. To this end, I can proudly state that to date, the DDOD has successfully completed and surpassed all the commitments as set out in their manifesto. Mr. Speaker, Gibraltar Car Park Limited continues to manage all covered and non-covered parking within the assigned car park by Gibraltar. They are responsible for keeping the car parks in check for maintenance issues and for their cleaning. Gibraltar Car Park Limited have assisted with the Ministry of Housing with the parking schemes within Chilton Court and out of Easter House. Recently, Gibraltar Car Park Limited has also been working within Mid-Harbour Estate to bring into use the much-needed parking barrier system within the estate, controlling access to those not from within the estate. This will go a long way in keeping such a large car park more secure. In particular this year, in fact, barely months ago, construction began on the 1,000-space multi-story car park within the Midtown, close to the city centre, on the site of the old Naval Civil Ground. 300 parking spaces have been sold to the limited public almost immediately. This building will house 700 public parking spaces together with Coach Park. The expected completion for this car park is within autumn 2015. Curling Island is another area that has been designated as a parking area for private vehicles. This area is full of great rivers and boats. The area is cleared on the 16th of October, 2014. This sea carpet was officially open to the general public, affording 2 disabled parking bays, 40 motorcycle bays, 8 motor vehicle parking bays, and 11 parking bays for DHA UNHC employees from the community mental health team. There is a second phase expected in this area once the works related to the Mid-Harbour new boat marina is complete. Mr. Speaker, I come to my responsibility for the code. During the course of financial year 2014-2015, the Gibraltar Port Authority spent a total of £5,650,323, including capital expenditure for a budget of £5,762,000. Under account revenue, the Gibraltar Port Authority made a total of £4,812,862. Looking at development, the new electronic vehicle management system is now fully operational and is allowing 6 agents to input data remotely in order to provide the most recent information on a vehicle's movement, further streamlining to the port operations. Feedback suggests that local agents in general are very satisfied with this new product. Nevertheless, the Gibraltar Port Authority continues to develop the program to facilitate further the smooth running of the port. Mr. Speaker, in fulfillment of further manifesto commitments, work continues to improve port facilities and infrastructure, including a provision for enhanced facilities for operational personnel. As part of this commitment, Haitian Government of Gibraltar continues to invest in the port. It also pleases me to announce today that work on the new port administration building, incorporating improved facilities and a better location for the vessel traffic service, the DCS office, the GPS North Centre is well underway. The concrete framework is fully complete and the first walls are starting to go up. Mr. Speaker, we are also considering the possibility of replacing the GPS equipment itself, de-risking the move and building an improved performance, functionality and resilience for years to come, in a system which underpins safety of navigation in our busy waters. It has been busy, and the project will be completed towards the end of this year, representing a substantial injection of capital investment in the port in order to fulfill yet another critical manifesto commitment. Mr. Speaker, the process of tendering for a new port launch is also well underway, and it is anticipated that a new vessel could be ordered within the next 12 months to considerably enhance this important capability. On security, Mr. Speaker, in addition to the new closed circuit television system that was introduced at the port 2 years ago, enhancing both safety and security, the government, in conjunction with the GPA and technical services, will be modifying the restricted area within the port estate to comply with the Department of Transport UK's recommendations. Linked to this, a new traffic management plan for taxis and coach will be implemented shortly to assist with passenger flow. Mr. Speaker, the first stage of the small boat marina, which will accommodate 700 small boats, has now been completed with the main perimeter quay having been laid. The second phase is well underway, along the main quayside, housing the infrastructure for all required services. Plans are also being considered for the use of the long outer dock for TPS. It is expected that the marina will be completed by September 2015 and the allocation process for berths is currently being considered and will be announced shortly. The GPA, in close consultation with other government departments and port operators, has recently revised its oil spill contingency plan. As a result, we now have a modern, up-to-date plan that reflects both the local environment and operations and investment in equipment by the government. The new plan encapsulates the provision of the additional 600 meters of oil spill containment boom purchased last year, already pre-positioned at both other entities to the west of Ocean Village. Mr. Speaker, this delivers a significant improvement in the response time to successfully mitigate any impact of pollution to these areas. The revised plan also includes the Vicoma alligator skimmer purchased the previous year. Looking ahead, the tender process for the delivery of a specialized oil spill detection radar is aimed to provide full-time dedicated coverage to all devoted police control waters is almost completed. A state-of-the-art low profile system adding an invaluable tool to the arsenal and disposal of the port authority to continue protecting our maritime environment. Mr. Speaker, further enhancements to the monitoring tools of the port authority, such as portable thermal imaging equipment, are also being considered. as a speaker of environmental health and safety advisor, is doing an excellent job in raising health and safety awareness throughout the port community, ensuring compliance with safety regulations and marine environmental legislation. I am pleased to say that this is resulting in a positive shift in the port workers' culture and behavior in this area of critical importance. More generally, it is pleasing to see that activity levels in the port are showing a positive trend across the board. The port continues to go from strength to strength. The recent doubling of VPS operations, together with the introduction of a number of initiatives aimed at further improving efficiency, are bearing fruit in commercial terms. Safety, of course, remains our top priority, and our professional crew members continue to play a pivotal role, providing a vital safe and rescue facility in our busy waters, 24 hours a day throughout the year, often in challenging and hazardous conditions. Mr. Speaker, I would like to conclude my contribution to my budget address, thanking all my staff that have worked so hard to see our commitments become a reality. Thanks to those not only today to ensure the rolling out of our commitments, my senior members of staff, but also to all those who do not go by unnoticed, who perform all the valuable functions within the service throughout all the various departments and offices. I also wish to reinforce my appreciation to all the staff here in Parliament, but who work tirelessly to ensure that proceedings run as smoothly and efficiently as they do. In particular, I would finally also like to thank my personal ministry of staff for all of the help and support during the past year. It has been a very busy year, and we have lived up to expectations as usual. Thank you.
Speaker, I move that the House will now adjourn until tomorrow morning at 10:30 a.m.
Before we do that, I had intended to raise a small matter to digress for a moment before I called upon Dr. John Cortez. The budget session is an occasion when there is a particular rule that becomes more relevant than on any other occasion, and that is Rule 45, subparagraph 3. In my mind, I'll be very blunt, it's a stupid rule. It's a rule that forbids members from reading their speeches. Of course, what is implicit is that they are able to do so with the permission of the Speaker, which the Speaker obviously readily gives. But why does that rule have to be there in the first place? I mean, is it because that is a rule in the Marble of Parliament? But it is a pretense, because even in the Marble of Parliament, they do read their speeches, though the Speaker pretends that they just have copious notes. Nonsense. They've got the speeches written out, and they read them. And that is what I did for 20 years that I was in the House. So this rule is a nonsense to my mind. Now, the House should have a standing rules committee. Do we have that? I can't speak in October, whereas the House started in January. There may or may not be. I'm not sure whether there is. If there is a standing rules committee, it would be the easiest thing in the world to circulate a round robin proposing that Rule 45(3) be deleted completely, I would suggest, and the other subparagraph be renumbered. That's what it says. But I cannot for the life of me understand the strength behind this rule, which is never observed, and as I say, I think it is nothing more than a pretense. So if honourable members agree with my sentiments, perhaps they can take some action in the future. They're going to be here longer than I am.
Thank you very much for pointing that out. But I've always found it something which is remarkable in the sense that it is a rule observed in its reach in the time of our history. And I believe there is a standing rules committee, which was appointed immediately after the election, and then backbench and I nominated people who have been on it from the beginning, and that we should rightly refer the matter to them, and I think the proposal would be made for that day to deal with it.
Your proposal of the House. Again, tomorrow morning at 10:30. The House will now adjourn tomorrow at 10:30.